This is Robert Stark. I'm here with Rabbit. Rabbit, it's great having you back on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pillator.
Hi, Rabbit. I'm a big fan of your work.
Oh, thank you.
Rabbit, you've been writing a lot lately. What have been some of the overall themes that you've been focusing on?
I don't know. Have I? Actually, I feel like I've been kind of slacking a little bit, but I think I just mostly just been writing on, more abstract, kind of meta political stuff about the alt-right and alt-left, that sort of thing. And, but nothing too specific. I mean, I reach a point where, I don't necessarily feel the need to, pontificate about everything. It's kind of like you said a bunch of stuff. I like to kind of drift off into doing like movie reviews and things like that.
Oh yeah, you've done a lot of movie reviews lately, and how you kind of relate them to the themes that you talk about. And we've been doing that a lot on this show. Pillator, do you want to announce our upcoming movie shows?
Yes, Robert has a plan to do The Crush with Alicia Silverstone. And that's a teen drama movie about some weird crush and having a crush on a girl that's kind of preppy, but kind of that typical high school drama. It sounds interesting, though. I have to... Interesting film. I was looking at it. The aesthetics are, I would say, interesting.
Yeah, I've seen it, actually. I've seen it, like, once in, like, 1996 or 97 or whenever it came out. But... I didn't think it was worth seeing again. So I don't even.
It didn't make a big impression on you?
No, it was just like a relatively average, 90s thriller. I don't remember it being, being very noteworthy. But at that time period when it came out, I probably wasn't very into whatever was currently out. I was probably watching stuff from like the 70s and 80s at that time. Like, I didn't appreciate a lot of that stuff until later, 90s movies. Like, I don't even think I really appreciated a lot of those 90s indie films until after the fact. Now you can see that they kind of have their place. They seem very distinct historically, is fitting within that time period.
You recently reviewed the film Porky's, titled it Porky's Pathological Altruism. How would you compare that to adult movies, adult comedy movies that are coming out today?
I think that the movies that are coming out today are just so, they kind of like try to be shocking and funny, but they're like, they're still like ultra... ultra PC, and I just think they're really bad. And then the ones that come out today always have, they don't really have any kind of charm about them. Like, those 80s comedies had a certain kind of charm, kind of like those movies like Shag and Porky's, that kind of thing. Whereas the newer stuff is just, it's just so commercialized and like hokey that it's just, there's just like a gag happening. Like, I'm thinking about like movies like the Hangover series, just this really kind of,
So our trip to Vegas was nothing like the Hangover.
No, thank God. It was like, it was so much more, it was on such a higher level. I felt like,
yeah, we were like, walking around like intellectuals visiting a museum, and I must have been the only person there. But it is an interesting place, because most people who go to Vegas, they just see it. It's just sort of a place to get either wasted or to gamble. But you could also see it as this kind of retro-futurist fantasy world set in this mountain desert setting. It's just kind of how you want to look at it in your experience with the place. I mean, there's a sense of place, and each person has their own personal reaction in relationship to a place.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, we did a whole show about this. I think, you know, more than one show about it. But, you know, when I go to Vegas, like, you know, and, you know, you're probably this way too, is like, I can be completely detached from the current, you know, culture and aesthetic that exists there. And, you know, when I'm walking around there, like, I can literally, like, block all of that stuff out, and just like, it's like I'm walking around in like the 1970s in Vegas, you know. And you know, you can't do that 100%, but it's like, you know, when I go there, I'm having a completely different mental experience than, you know, 90% of the people that are there. And just kind of like when you go to these buildings and stuff, like, you know, the people who go to Circus, you know, they're just looking to stay in like a cheap you know, older casino that's a cheap place that's, you know, kind of dumpy, that's like close to cool stuff or whatever. But the, you know, when I go into Circus, I, you know, I just picture those scenes from Diamonds Are Forever, you know, that were shot there. And I'm totally like, I'm in awe when I walk through it, even though the place is like a total, you know, total dump at this point, although it has gotten kind of revived a little bit. I hope that the casinos that remain from that period, I hope they find a way to keep them around. But it's just really not, Vegas just isn't really that kind of place for historical preservation. It just doesn't seem like anyone really gives a shit.
Yeah, we did a show on that with this woman, Lynn Zuck, and she was saying the last older hotel casinos are Circus, the Flamingo where we stayed, and Tropicana on the South Strip, and those are all probably the most in danger of being demolished or completely remodeled. Did you ever get a chance to go to Caesar's Palace before they renovated it in the 90s? I know it was more of a 1960s kind of Roman aesthetic, but the original Caesar's Palace was kind of, reminds me of that vaporwave look. Have you seen pictures of it even?
Yeah, vaguely. I mean, I remember the famous like footage of Evel Knievel crashing, like trying to jump the fountain there in the 60s. I don't know if you've ever watched that. And it was just classic like 1960s. You know, it looks like he shot on like Super 8 a camera or something. But he tried to jump over the fountain with a motorcycle, and he had like a horrendous crash. And that used to be a thing that the daredevils would try and whatnot, but I've never actually, I wasn't actually there before they remodeled it.
Pilliter, I showed you those pictures of the Wynn. Do you think it has kind of an Asian Aryan aesthetic? Like there's aspects, it's a sort of futuristic interpretation of a fusion of like Parisian culture with like Chinese and Japanese culture.
I like the flowers. They remind me of very pretty, it's very colorful. I was thinking the first thing of the Captain Harlock movie, the CGI film that recently came out, and some of the buildings in that were very circular and flowers. Even though that was a computer animated film, looking at in with flowers, and actually, yes, there is this fusion between the nice bonsai look of getting flowers right and compared to the very European walkway, you know, you have a mix in there, and all you have to do is put some alienoid people in there, and I guess you could say it's an out there or alien kind of setting. So I would agree, yeah, in some exotic sense, there it definitely might belong to exotic alien people.
Would it be fit for Padalero?
If you put more of the Beardsley and the Harry O'Clark and the Art Nouveau gothic style with a bunch of cross-dressing men than Asian men, then probably, yeah.
What the Wynn kind of reminds me of, since you're talking about the inside of it, it actually reminds me of Willy Wonka's like chocolate factory in like the old one,
yeah.
You know, where the you know, it falls in with like the lollipop thing or whatever, like in the water. You know, when they're in that, like, I haven't seen it probably in like 15 years or something, but you know what, you know, when they're in the kind of foresty area in there, like.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what part I'm talking about?
Yes, and it's very
maybe you've never even seen it.
I like that. Rabbit, have you ever seen the recent movie The Founder?
No, I mean, I haven't really seen I haven't seen any recent movie other than like a handful of them that I got like roped into seeing because I was like with some girl or something. But I haven't seen very many.
The Founder is about Ray Kroc and his journey to create the McDonald's empire, and the whole movie takes place in this weird late 1950s aesthetic, and it's basically a whitetopia, Midwest, California, kind of in Robert's area of just this, a lot of architect in there too with the whole neon and just him trying to get Michael Keaton trying to get out his cheeseburgers or milkshakes and with these weird other people and just loving that McDonald's empire and then him succeeding with his empire and then finally taking place at the end in 70 where he's going to meet Ronald Reagan. But it takes a good place among in the, I don't know, it just gave me some weird alt-left aesthetic in a new time.
Maybe, you know, I actually liked, you know, Michael Keaton in the 80s. He kind of looked like my dad a little bit. You know, my dad got like a, you know, always got like a perm like in the 80s and he kind of looked like Michael Keaton a little bit.
What's interesting yeah, is no, how each decade kind of has nostalgia and fetishizes a previous decade. And there was a 50s nostalgia in the 80s, definitely. You comment on that in Porky's, but also in films like Back to the Future and also the early 60s, like with films like Dirty Dancing. And it's interesting is I got into 80s music when I was a teenager, but the only like really faint memory I have of the 80s is like taking some road trip as a little kid and hearing like some like early 60s kind of doo-wop music on like the oldie station. But I think there was this nostalgia for the 50s and early 60s in the 80s. And you write about that in your review of Porky's.
Yeah. And also the movies like The Outsiders, you know, that came out in the 80s. Because like I was, you know, a full on, like 80s kid, like that was like, you know, I'd like the Garbage Pail Kids, like Jean Jackets, you know, the whole, you know, my friend, you know, in like third grade had one of those like Michael Jackson, like jackets with like the zippers, you know, it was like one of those red, like, I mean, we had like a, you know, a band, like I had like a Fraggle Rock drum set. It was, I mean, it's just kind of like I was just a totally 80s kid, you know, with like the sunglasses and everything, just even as like an 8 or 10 year old kid. But yeah, that was totally, yeah, I was an 80s kid, like throughout the whole decade. It kind of defined my childhood, you know, in every like 80s movie, you know, that's all those like 80s fantasy movies that like kids see, like The Dark Crystal and The Secret of NIMH was like a big, but when I saw The Secret of NIMH as a kid, I actually used to go outside and we had these like bushes and I used to like build structures and toy structures in the bushes, like as it would be like home for like the rats, like in The Secret of NIMH. Like that's how like weird of a kid I was. Like I did stuff like that, you know, after seeing movies.
Are you more fascinated with the 80s or the era previous to that? Like, would you say your absolute favorite is the mid-century space age aesthetic?
That's my favorite. Like, the 80s, I feel more of like a personal like connection to or like ownership of, you know, like it's kind of like, oh, you know, those were my days. Like, so it's like you may not have like, I don't know. It's just, for me, like the 80s were, you know, they were my childhood. And I always feel like it was kind of it was like the last time I really lived in the present, you know, where I was like into the current stuff. Cause when I got into like, even in like 1994 and stuff in 93, 94, I was like, that was like when I stopped living in the present, like around the early 90s or something, when I started to like be nostalgic for like these 80s movies. And I started like being really into, in the 90s, like I was kind of into the 70s too. So I would always wear like those, you know, those baseball shirts, like you always saw like in the 70s and 80s where the, they would be like white shirts with the, where the sleeves would be like blue or red or yellow or something. You see those like in 70s and 80s movies. You might not recognize them, but like if you picture, if watch like the Bad News Bears or something, that's kind of what I'm talking about. But I was like, even in, I was nostalgic for like the 80s, even in like 1993 or something, you know, like the 80s didn't really come back until like way later. But I remember being like nostalgic for it while the 90s were like just getting big. And then, you know, then I went through a period after that when I was like nostalgic for the 90s. But I would say that aesthetically, at a certain point, I just got really into mid-century modern. And that's kind of like the pinnacle of like what I'm into.
In your review of Porky's, like the opening scene is it's the neon sign of the pigs for the Porky's Club. And it's one of those old like movable signs that are in motion, movable signs. But those are extremely rare today. I don't know if I've ever seen one of those. I've seen one. I'm sure you see them in Vegas, but Rabbit, have you ever seen one of those movable signs in person like they have in Porky's? I think, yeah, it takes place in the 50s, so that's one of those most common.
Yeah, I don't think that I've ever, at least I can't think of one that I've seen. I'm sure that I must have seen. I mean, the closest thing I can think of was like, you know, being in like bars with my dad as a kid when either would be like neon signs in the bars that would have like movable, and also like there would be these weird kind of beer signs that would have like a waterfall or so, like Hams beer, you know, or something like that. And I always thought that stuff was really cool. But it's funny that you bring up the neon sign in Porky's, because I figured you would be like excited by something like that, because you just love that those those neon signs, and that is an especially good one too.
Do you like the 80s arcade aesthetic and the sort of 80s nightclub where they have a lot, it's all like dark and it's like pink and turquoise neon, like kind of cyberpunk, what cyberpunk is based on?
No, I actually don't really like that. I think it's kind of gross. Like what comes to mind, I think, is like the bar nightclub scene in like the first Terminator, you know, when she runs in there to hide and he goes in there and starts like shooting up the place or whatever. Like I hated that, that whole look of bars and whatnot. I just thought it was really like, grimy and kind of gross. And I think that like the women from like the styles from that area, like the women look really bad, like even when they're in their prime, like just like really like really just like seem really unattractive
when I was to me, where I like
the 60s women.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, I always was confused too when looking at the girls in the 80s. They always had big puffy hair and like four eyes glasses, as if they put a weird shampoo in their hair and just like pooped out like a women's afro. I never really understood that. Never found it attractive.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't either. Whereas if you, like the women in the '60s, I think that is ideal. Not like the gross, like hippies,
not the hippies,
like you know, 65,
but the early 60s with like the short mini skirts. Like the JFK.
Well, even up to maybe like 66 or 67, you know, when you have like, Raquel Welch and, you know, like Modesty Blaise and that kind of, so just these really attractive, you know, women, even just a lot of these like mod girls, I really, even if you look at old magazine ads from the 60s, like it's just some of like I think the women like never looks better than in those.
You mean like Faye Dunaway or Dusty Springfield?
Well, Faye Dunaway I was never a fan of, but I just mean if you just look at the you know kind of just no, like no name, like just look at magazine ads from, look at magazine ads from like a women's magazine in the 60s, and it's just like really gorgeous to set. And then like even the ads themselves just have like really great color usage.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the way the women are portrayed in that film, Porky's, you were talking about? And you also comment on racial stereotypes in the film too.
Well, see, that was I revisit a lot of these movies because I remember them fondly from my childhood. So I just decide I'm going to finally get this thing on DVD and watch it, cause I haven't seen it in forever. And, I don't know. I noticed that, I don't remember what I said about the women in Porky's, but I think, what's her name from, Kim Cattrall.
Kim Cattrall. She looks,
yeah. She just looks absolutely banging in that movie. Like just like super hot and like, which is kind of weird because, you know, when in the newer set, like what she's known for is like the more like Sex and the City. And that's, I think like she's totally like unlikable in that, but in,
well, the thing about Sex and the Porky's is, like, Kim Cattrall's character is Samantha, is very crude, obnoxious, but at least she's honest and upfront about what she is. Like, the Carrie character, played by Sarah Jessica Parker, she's this total whore, but then she's, like, all about, entitled to, like, having a relationship. At least Samantha's, like, the most honest about out of the characters about what she's about.
Yeah, I just remember thinking that show was awful and that all of the people had just really horrible personalities. Whereas if you look at the stuff from Kim Cattrall's earlier career, like she was in an episode of the TV series of Logan's Run, the TV version, and she's great in that. And she's like great in all of this other earlier stuff where she's really comes off as really attractive and likable and having a lot of depth. And it's weird that the thing that she's probably most known for is just like a really garbagey show.
And the show, it's such a ridiculous show, but one of our previous guests, Ray Sahil, said when he was living in New York, you would have all these young women on trust funds move to New York just because of that show.
Yeah, I mean, I believe it. And they probably like, you know, dream about living there. But I also remember when I was in Vegas, I remember there was a Sex in the City themed slot machine that was, I don't know why that just came to mind. It was like one of those giant ones too, like the kind that like, you know, that you never want to play because like, it's just there to entertain you. Like, you're not going to win anything. Yeah.
Do you remember the frog machine at the Excalibur and you put it on Frog Twitter?
Yeah, of course. I absolutely remember that. That was just a very, very lucky find, I guess. It was just especially because I ran into it when I'm hanging out with you. So it was like if I was just there by myself, like there would have been no one to share the moment with that would have had any idea. Because remember, like back then, like that was before all of that stuff really hit it big to where anyone would recognize it.
Maybe if we went to the Luxor, we would have found Keck. What are your thoughts on the like infamous shower scene in that film?
Oh, it's actually like, I don't know. It's actually pretty like stupid and cheesy. Like it's just kind of, I don't know. I guess like one thing that really stands out to me about that show is that it's just incredibly sexist. But like everyone in the movie is like cool with the sexism. You know, like the women are cool with it too because like they kind of get their revenge also. You know, so it's not really like this whole thing. I mean, I feel like it would have. You know, you'd never be able to make that I don't think, again, very, very easily without, you know, without making the men look much more horrible. But that is one thing that's interesting, though, is that it's, it does have that, like, racial subplot to it. And I wrote about that in my article, that it was, I found that it was, like, really annoying because it was just really shoehorned in there.
Oh, like caricatures of the rednecks?
No, there's a subplot where there's a Jewish guy at the school, and then you have like there's this one like really bigoted guy that's always like made to look like a complete idiot, and he's like just totally like bullying this guy, and then the kid ends up like you know, he beats him up, you know, but then of course it turns out like that the bigoted guy, like he's only bigoted because, or you know, he's only racist because his dad abuses him, you know, and all this. It's just kind of like, but it's really just, it seems really out of place, and it's kind of like, it's a really phony way of like, and I watched the commentary and whatnot with an interview with the director, and he was like, well, you know, I had to give, you know, this some depth, so I had to give, you know, some reasons for why this kid was racist like he was, but it's totally like shallow because it's like the most cliched thing ever, you know, like it couldn't just be like that.
It's like, you know, saying
that the kid was,
it's like saying like, oh well, the reason why you don't like black people is because you never had sex with a black woman before. You know, if that's
or just something like that. Like, of course he had to come from like an abusive home, and his dad was an alcoholic, and that's why he was, it couldn't have been because like his, you know, like his sister was like raped, you know, by a black guy or something, or, you know what I mean? Like, even in like American History X, you know, which is like a totally like propaganda, like, film, like even there, they really, do actually make an effort to, you know, to convey like what, these other people, what their grievances are. They kind of do it, at least, you know, not in a totally genuine way, but they at least like make the effort, you know, it's not just total, like total bullshit.
So that's basically why you titled the post Porky's and Pathological Altruism.
Well, no, that's not why. The reason why is because, you know, the director, okay, like he went out of his way to throw that in there and signal like against like, you know, racism and bigotry and all that. And then, you know, of course, like while I was watching, like I looked him up on Wikipedia, and it turned out that the director was actually killed by an illegal alien Mexican drunk driver or something that killed him and his son in an auto accident. So it's kind of, it's one of those things where it's like the, you know, this person, like, you know, he focused his energy signaling like how bad this white racism was. And of course, like he ends up, you know, he ends up getting killed in a drunk driving accident, like, you know, by like one of his, like, his pets, like maybe, you know, maybe these people need to focus like in another direction. You know, so that was why I called it pathological altruism, is because he put all his focus on sticking up for these people, you know, and then he ended up getting killed by them. Like, whereas he kind of like totally denigrated these other people as being like losers coming from a broken home. Like, well, you know, when I watched it, it was the same time as the news story came out about that, you know, that MP or whatever, that, I don't know who he was. He was some government official, like pro refugee government official in Europe, that his daughter was, raped and murdered by refugees. Even she was like trying to help refugees, and she was part of some pro-refugee organization, and she got raped and murdered by, you know, this dad who's a government official in Europe. And so that happened at the same time I was watching this movie and watching this other thing. So I kind of tied it to that as being just a certain mindset of these people.
It's hard to really understand where these people are coming from because on one hand, you have a lot of people in power in the media, Hollywood, the government, and corporations, and they do stuff as a way of it's virtue signaling to show their status. But when it comes to how they treat people in person, a lot of them are really awful people in how they treat other people. But then, do you think a lot of these people that you're talking about, they just genuinely believe in this altruistic ideology to the point they end up destroying themselves or leading to their own family members, horrible things happening to their family? So I think there's different types of people with different motivations. I think both are accurate.
Yeah, I think that, like part of it is you know, signaling that they're a good person. But I think that they do, a lot of them do genuinely believe this stuff. At least they may not act it out, but it's like they, you know, they definitely buy into it. I mean, in the case of the director, it's a little bit different because he was, you know, he made that movie in the early 80s or whatever. So coming from his perspective then, as, you know, he was someone who had lived in Florida and in the South, you know, in the 50s and 60s. So it was kind of, and that film was apparently, according to him, it was based on stories from those areas that were true in those days.
Florida is a very weird place because you have this kind of culture clash, because you have this very, traditionally it's been very redneck. Then you have the whole Southern culture, including rednecks and blacks. You have a lot of the immigrants from Latin America. Then you have a lot of Jews coming down from New York. So it's kind of, I think Florida is a unique place where you have these different cultures in the same geographic region. California, I don't know if you really, maybe you do to some degree in some places, but I think Florida is unique in that sense.
Well, I think that California maybe used to be like that, but because you used to have like Orange County, you know, which was totally different than, you know, San Francisco and Los Angeles. But now those all kind of have at least very similar political cultures, not necessarily like aesthetic cultures, like definitely not. But whereas Florida, you know, you have multiple big cities in Florida, but like, you know, places like Jacksonville and Pensacola are nothing like Miami or Orlando. And these other kind of places. And you have St. Petersburg and Tampa. So you have all of these big cities, like you said, that some of the big cities even have fairly different cultures, where in California, like you might have the difference is in some of the smaller towns and like the rural areas. But like, you know, the cities, if you leave Sacramento and San Francisco and Los Angeles, and now even the cities in Orange County are all pretty pretty similar. So I think Florida is unique in that. But the director who lived in that area in the 50s and 60s probably saw some things which influenced his perspective to you know, add the anti-racist narrative. So that is, you know, coming from a different place. But I think that you also should acknowledge that, like, we're in a different place completely now. So a lot of these people that are very, you know, anti-white or anti-racist, as they would say, are, you know, they're using a caricature that isn't, they're not accurately citing the motivations of, like, why people are, you know, why people are concerned about race now. It's, you know, in like the 1940s, it's a completely different situation now.
I know in the film with the whole like shower scene, I think boys growing up always have this fantasy of what the girls' locker room is like. And it's funny because I know Steve Saylor, wrote this reference, this article about showering and how showering's gone out of style. Because I remember being in high school and I would use the locker. I went to like a ghetto, kind of a ghetto high school, and I would use the locker room, but there was this old vacant shower that was just sitting there. Like it hasn't been used in decades.
No, that's true. And I remember actually like, when I was in high, even like when I was in grade school, I was like, gee, like when I get to high school, like it's going to really suck having to like shower with all these people. Like that's going to be gross. Like, then when I got to high school, they didn't do that anymore. So it was like, and that was like in the 90s.
I have shower stories.
I mean, you know, maybe they would maybe be like a couple. But like one weird like super jock or something who might like take a shower after gym class or something. But nobody like, you know, nobody did it. Like they would have thought you were a total weirdo. Like if you took a shower after gym class, like they probably would have like fucked with you or something just because you were weird enough to do that.
In swimming class,
but yeah,
you have to take a shower. And I remember like almost 10 years ago, just like taking a shower of all these guys, and guys would be like wiggling their dicks at each other. I mean, I'm serious. It was like this weird, like it was weird and homoerotic, but at the same time was like masculine. And they would be like, yo, you see this girl? She's got the biggest, fattest tits ever. Blah, blah, blah. And then they would be like to me, hey, yo, take off your pants. Let me see it. I'm like, I don't know about it. What are you, gay? And it was like this really strange, But for the girls' class, the girls' room, I remember just being bored one day at gym, and I didn't want to do gym, so I was walking the hallways, and I got so bored, I walked into the girls' shower room, because I was just bored. Nobody was in there, and all I saw was, like, a big, fluffy sofa, this big sign that say, hey, girls, stay positive, don't be depressive, and all, like, this girly stuff, and I was thinking to myself, dang, why doesn't the men's room have, like, a couch, a TV, all this stuff? The women have just, like, this pedestal on them. So that's my thoughts on it.
But. Oh, I gotta mention something real quick. That reminds me of, like, when I go to, like, the gym today, like, that there's, like, the locker room, and there's always, like, these, you know, it seems like this is a thing at, like, any gym, but there's always these, like, old, there's always, like, in the men's locker room, these old dudes that hang out and they're naked. You know, whereas, like, most younger people or, like, normal people, like, they just go in, change real quick and, like, you know, use the bathroom and get the hell out of there or something. But
yeah,
whenever
you,
there's always these old dudes, like, just hanging around,
thing.
Like, buck naked. And like with like their bare ass like sitting on a bench, you know, with like the ball sack like on the bench, and you're just like, oh, dude, you know, like, why would you want to just like hang out like, you know, naked for like 45 minutes in a locker room, like just chilling with your buds, like what? I don't get it, you know. I go in there and like I just want to get out of there.
Yeah, I was.
You know,
the same
I just
way
go
too.
In there to pee real quick and like change clothes, and then I'm in the gym, like not. It's not a hangout place. It's just, I don't know. It's something where it's like, it's an old dude thing because I don't think younger people do it. One thing that annoys me about the younger people in the gym though, is that you have these dudes that like go in the bathroom, like mirrors, and are just like taking selfies and like primping. And it's just like, dude, like, you know, give me a break. You're gross. Like it's disgusting. Like it's just, you just see those dudes that they're kind of, you know, those like bathroom mirror, like selfie dudes, like that's how cheesy they are. But like, just like primping, like, in the gym bathroom. And it's like, dude, like, you know, just handle your business in here and get out. Like you could do that primping shit, like in your own bathroom somewhere. Cause it's just so cheesy. Like, I don't know.
There's this, Guard, a Danish filmmaker, he's homosexual, Lasse Nielsen, and he makes all these like films of like shower scenes. And we were kind of joking on a previous show that's kind of like the aesthetic of all these homosexuals in like the alt-right movement.
Well, for Lasse Nielsen, I found him quite interesting because, one, he had You Are Not Alone, which seemed to be a cult film of some sort of coming to age in that 70 period. And now it's strange is because all his films after that seems to be just boy love, giving him the bad reputation that he's into child pornography. Even on his YouTube channel, there are weird boy love NAMBLA guys all over that. And you have to question what Nielsen's really after, even though he seems to be the avant-garde sensitive type, and he has Parkinson's now and just shakes and says this and that. He's a complicated figure. But it reminds me of these other photographers like Richard Kern, who he worked for Sonic Youth. He takes pictures of these strange urbanite, you know, like white girls in their bras, and they're doing weird things all over each other in the bathtub. Just you look at the figure in some kind of punk style. And then you have another guy named Jock Sturgeons, who's, I think that's how you pronounce Sturgeons, who basically does nude adolescence of like little girls. And some of it's a little too, once again, the whole Lassie Nielsen thing, but he's more, I guess it's more just little girls doing it. And, but the point is, like, along with Will McBride and the whole show me thing, it's this, you like the aesthetic of this youth. And I guess they were from that 60s period. I mean, if you think of film as a moving picture show and you look at film as art on the wall and just put your sound on mute, no sound, just look at the picture on the wall, it becomes an animated fine art piece. And I guess that's what Nielsen thinks about films and some of these more avant-garde types. But for the photographer, you're trying to make photo pictures as fine art. I mean, I think of the most radical of these guys would probably be Larry Clark, who did Tulsa, you know, doing the heroin addict pieces, guys. And
interesting about Larry Clark is with Lasse Nielsen, David Hamilton, Jock Sturgis, there is something kind of utopian and almost like a traditional European society about it.
Yes.
Larry Clark's film Kids portrays more of a society in decay as opposed to more of the imagery of the other artist.
Same with Ken Park and his other films. It's definitely, and the other film, Lassie Nielsen would be the right wing conservative and Larry Clark would be the left wing, degenerate dystopian. That's an interesting compare and contrast, but they both come from that same background, if you think about it.
No comment. Really, I don't have any.
Huh. Rabbit, you did write about Backpage's greatest hits and how Backpage has been shut down recently.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Backpage was always like a great source of amusement and entertainment to me. Like late at night and stuff, I would look at the ads and just like I would read like these. I stumbled on like many years ago to these like review sites where people would like leave their reviews of like different like Backpage escorts and whatnot, and I stumbled onto them like by accident because I was wanting to buy a condo, you know, so I looked up the address of a place, you know, that was for sale. And it turned out that it used to be an apartment and it was like mentioned in one of these reviews. And, you know, and the review was something like ridiculous, like, you know, make sure that if you go to see, you know, Pixie on 12th Street in Medlock that, you know that there's a guy named T-Bone, apparently he hides in the closet and films the whole thing. You know, and it was just like this really ridiculous like review, and I just became addicted to like reading these things when I was bored. And so like every couple months or something, if I was bored, I would just go through in these forums and just read.
You were never a connoisseur of the services they provided.
No, I mean, I'm too much of like a germaphobe in real life. Like I'm a major hypochondriac. So like, and also, you know, I think I wrote about this also, but like these escorts and hookers in real life, like they're not like these, they're not real prizes that you would really pay for. Like a lot of the photos and stuff are fake and stuff. So, but of the real, you know, the actual legit escorts, they're mostly like you wouldn't, you know, like they couldn't pay you to have sex with them because most of them look like kind of messed out, you know, or just they look pretty beat, you know, or they'll be like these like kind of like cougars, but like not really attractive, like just kind of like, you know, look like a 45-year-old woman that works at like 7-Eleven or something like that. Just totally beat. So, but yeah, yeah. I'm too much of a germaphobe.
I'm not speaking from experience, but I've heard people say they've gone to these like legal brothels and like some of cases, like you have like these, like the women you're describing charging these outrageous rates, like almost $1,000 at these legal brothels in Nevada.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess you, you know, I'm sure you get what you pay for, but the, I mean, in my opinion, like just the risk isn't worth it. Even just reading the reviews and stuff, the, you know, there's so many cases of people like going into shady situations and like, you know, getting like robbed and then like forced to like have to run across the street naked, like, you know, to safety or something like that. Just kind of like these totally jacked situations and even just really disgusting, sexual situations that are just like really just these horror stories, you know, and it's just like for the, I mean, it just doesn't seem like worth it. Like, I'm just like, I guess I'm just not that,
there's a book, know, there's
I'm,
a book,
I'm not that necessary.
There's a book by Peter Sotos and it's called Index and it's all about horror stories of classified adult ads and about what it
could. Is this the one that deals with Jamie Gillis?
No, that's pure filth. There's an older book called Index and I have a copy and I just think it's funny because all he does is quotes in these like realistic adult ads like from back pages and they're like horrifying and disgusting and kind of, he also recounts people's when they did these things and they're just weirdo stuff. And but I know it makes me think that the back pages or Craigslist adult services seem to be like an older audience when in fact all the young kids are using like Tinder prostitution but keeping it on the low or something.
Yeah, I think that even if you, you know, if you wanted to do that sort of thing, there's just so many like scams and so much BS that it's just like, you know, for all the work that it takes a person to navigate it, to find that you're legit, like you're better off just like going to a bar or something and just, you know, snagging whatever you can get your hands on. Just like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, for all the effort that you have to put into it, you know, you might as well just like try to meet an actual girl if you're gonna have to invest this much effort into trying to find something that, you know, that isn't a catfish or isn't a, like a scam, and you're not going to get robbed or, you know, you're not going to get busted. Cause like, that's like one of the worst things you can be busted for because like, you know, you have like a mugshot for that. And then it's just like really embarrassing.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting, you know, because I mean, a lot of these local governments go out of their way to like humiliate the Johns. And it's kind of like we live in this liberal, so-called liberal society, but we have this kind of authoritarian, neo-puritanical element.
Well, it's just weird because they, you know, they push all of the most like depraved and like degenerate, like sexual stuff as being like normalized, but then so you wind up with all of these like super horny, like freaky people that like, you know, they're suddenly looking for like an outlet for this weird shit. And then you arrest them after you spent their whole lives to social engineering them into thinking, you know, into sexualizing everything. Then it's like, oh, you know, they want to engage in that stuff. And then you bust them. And I realize that, you know, it's not necessarily the same people doing it, but there's also, you have those, it isn't just the hardcore Christians or whatever that, you know, that stop people from doing that stuff. Cause at least, I mean, they're being consistent, you know, when they oppose it, but then you have these, feminists and whatnot that they don't like the objectification and they don't want, you know, they like these dykey, you know, feminist women that are just kind of like, they're also like real prudish about this stuff and they don't like women being sexualized in this way and they think it's sexist. So they push just as hard. It's almost like this weird alliance between these bull dyke, really kind of like stick in the mud feminists, and and these hardcore traditionalist Christians that both kind of team up to shut this shit down.
Rabbit, you wrote this article, The Alt-Left Tea Party, and you do get into the cultural issues, but you do comment on your sort of interest in the alt-left is a lot of people who, on the alt-right, they say the 60s were bad, they hate draft dodgers were traitors, McCarthy was right, I hate modern architecture, etc. I mean, who were you referencing to?
Well, I mean, not one specific person, but it's clear that, I mean, it was clear to me anyways from, you know, being involved in that realm that there were, you know, most of the people have it assumed that they're like conservatives and traditionalists, and it's kind of like they're like a GOP plus, you know, so there's a good portion of the alt-right that are like these, you know, traditional Catholic types that are just like, or you have people who would have been like Ted Cruz supporters, but just like plus racism, you know, and there's this assumption that, you know, that just because you might have similar views on like white identity or not, that you would sign on for all of this other crap. And like, I was never, you know, into it. Like, I always hated it when people would post these memes, like, you know, here's a church from the 1800s, and then here's one from the 60s. Like, look how, you know, horrible modernity is. And I would look and I'd be like, well, I actually like the one, like the newer one better, you know, like,
Constantine von Hofmeister, who we're going to have in this show, he's a fan of like brutalism.
Yeah, totally. And I have always been a fan of Constantine's, writing. I thought he was on a kind of, he had very similar, similar ideas. And that was kind of the, you know, to the extent that I am, I can identify with right wing stuff. It's more of that, like, you know, Italian futurism, like the early, you know, precursors of stuff to fascism, not so much like the Nazi stuff, but, you know, like a lot of the aesthetics of Italian fascism and like Oswald Mosley.
There is this series called Man in a High Tower based on the Philip K. Dick novel, and we're actually going to do a show on it pretty soon. What was interesting is they use the 70s or more kind of 60s futurist brutalist aesthetic to depict the skyscraper headquarters for the Nazi occupation government in New York City.
Yeah, I don't watch it, but that's awesome if they do. But that's, you know, but continuing with what we were talking about, though, it's kind of like there's a presumption that you sign on for all this other stuff, like, you know, being against, quote, they always talk about like, quote unquote, modernity, you know, and it's like, well, no, I actually like modernity, except for like this, you know, all of this like anti-white stuff and like some of like the, you know, maybe some of the way that our policies are or something like that. That doesn't mean that like, you know, I want to live in like a Norman Rockwell painting or something like that, you know, or that I have any affinity. It's all just presumed that you are. They also have a, you know, granted, there are a lot of different factions in the alt-right, but when, at least when I was in there for a significant period of time, I wanted to get involved with the alt-left because I wanted to, you know, attract people who were, had similar cultural and not just aesthetics, you know, because that's can be kind of superficial, but also had had more of like a liberal worldview. You know what I mean? Because like, I don't, you know, I think that the Vietnam War was like was a terrible idea. And if you take a lot of these, you know, these, a lot of people on the alt-right, like they're still, even though they've kind of, they're quote, like red pilled, they haven't like reassessed the entire framework. So they still work within this thing of like, you know, calling people communists and like, and, you know, and somehow like, you know, vilifying all of these people from like the, I mean, the people in the 60s, like they were being screwed over, you know, they were being drafted to go fight in this foreign war that like wasn't in our interests. So like all of these people who were, you know, protesting the draft and whatnot, like, you know, they weren't necessarily like they weren't necessarily like unpatriotic or whatever. Like we had no business, like what a, you know, what a waste your life would be if you were like, you know, 18 or 19 years old and just like forced to go to some foreign country to just fight in like a totally pointless war and die. Like, you know, if I was living in that period of time, like I would have protested too. You know, I wouldn't have gone.
There's this one English writer that I like named Brian Aldiss, and he was drafted into, I think it was one of the Vietnam or Korean wars. I think it was the Vietnam War. And although he did not like it, he said the best thing he found was a Vietnamese woman. And he basically, they married, they were with together. And then the worst thing that has happened to him, he wrote during his wartime, was she left him or something like that, or he had to go, and he never wrote back, could not find her. And then he wrote a book called the, I think it was Hard Boiled Soldier, which I read some time ago, but it just reminds me of that. Like the only other reason you would be drafted into Vietnam is the exotic beauty of a different country. But other than that, as portrayed in most, it's pretty much a hell zone and you'll probably get bullets fly through and most people are going to get hurt with the technology of that back then.
Yeah, like stepping on landmines and like wading through like these swamps. It's just like, you know, getting like bit by bugs. And it's also, you know, people always, they always bag on like boomers, you know, especially these young people as being like this generation that screwed everything up. And like, I don't think that that's necessarily true. Like that, you know, the boomers weren't old enough. Like the people who did like the 1965 Immigration Act were like the generation before that. And the you know, the people who did
like LBJ and Ted Kennedy.
Right. And not just that issue, but like on a range of stuff, you know, like, so the generation before, like they were, you know, they overthrew, you know, the democratically elected leader in Iran and installed the Shah, you know, and that just caused like, that had repercussions that like we still see today in those countries. And, you know, they went to war in Korea, you know, and sent people to war there, which was another war that like we had no business being in. And we're still caught up in that conflict, you know, 60 or almost 70 years later. And so, you know, they got us into all these wars and were overthrowing governments and, you know, interfering, rigging elections and things like that. And it was just a, so I'm not a fan of boomers really, but I think that, you know, you can look at things from other perspectives where like the, you know, the generation before that, like they weren't like these, you know, these amazing people. And then boomers put everything, like the people before that were the ones who set up a lot of stuff where, you know, they used up a lot of the goodwill and they wasted it by these conflicts like Vietnam, which were actually like became a vehicle for these other, agitating groups to become more prominent because they had a reason, they had something that they could latch onto to, you know, and that ultimately led to a lot of other different, policies that we see now, because the people, the quote, you know, before the boomers, they gave all these people something to, legitimate grievances that they could use to catapult their own agenda.
I saw the same trend with George Bush in the Iraq War. I mean, people saw George Bush as being right wing, so they automatically wanted to be liberal. And I mean, my generation that came of age in the Bush era became a lot of them became liberal because of how much of a disaster George Bush was.
Yeah, totally. And then also, he was a disaster, and a lot of the people, like, it's the same situation where he squandered a lot of the goodwill, because he was very popular, you know, like initially, like after 9/11, and you know, one wonders how it could have turned out if he would have just gone a different way. But you know, then again, like, I have a feeling that, you know, if he would have done any of the things that, you know, that maybe you or I would have wanted, that, you know, he would have been vilified, like, you know, like Trump is now, essentially, like.
So in your article, The Alt-Left Tea Party, you do reference the Peter Sellers and Dudley Moore Alice in Wonderland film. And that was part of the inspiration for your moniker, I know, remember, besides the Rabbit Run novel by Updike.
Yeah, it was both of those two things. And I mean, I brought up that film because I've seen it thousands of times. But also, I feel like, you know, when I got involved with the alt-left, I always thought of it as something that would kind of augment the alt-right, like not outright oppose it. It was kind of like a way to introduce like white identity, you know, from a different angle to attract people, you know, who didn't want to sign on for all this other crap, you know, that just wanted to be, you know, that had similar interests to me. Because if you're in these movements, right, then at a certain point you think, like, you know what, like, this kind of sucks. Like, I need to, like, I want to, like, you know, meet or get involved with at least some people in this that actually, like, have similar interests. You know, my point with that was basically, like, that what ended up happening is that the alt-left ended up just attracting basically just any kind of, like, weirdos that didn't but we didn't fit into the alt-right for any reason.
Oh, yeah. You
know? Not necessarily for the reasons that it was just anyone who was, like, really just too weird to fit into the alt-right, or to consider, had some kind of weird esoteric, like, affectation or something like that, that they were, you know, some kind of weird fetish. It just attracted all of these.
I think a lot,
like,
of people would say that
weirdos
about Pillater and me.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, especially from my own backgrounds. I mean, I don't know.
You know, not just the two of you, but also just so many, like random people that, like, reach out to me or start following me, or, you know, send me emails or something like that. It's just, some of it is just, like, the most, like, you know, just the zaniest, like, characters that are just, like, where I just, like, this, I see their writing or something like that, or their opinions, and I'm just like, you know, like, what on earth caused this person to, like, read my writings and think that, like, you know, that where he read my stuff and thought, like, oh yeah, this is the movement for me, you know, because I'm reading it and I, like, this person has, like, the opposite opinions of me, but he's just weird, you know, something like that.
Who are mismatchers, that means, like, they don't fit into one of the clear political boxes. They have these eccentric, esoteric political views, and they're looking for a place to fit in. And some of those people drifted to the alt-right, but then the alt-right said, like, you're too much of a degenerate or a weirdo, so then they look for a new home.
I mean, I'm just, I wouldn't really say it's alt-right. I would say it's more avant-garde and eccentric street culture. And I'm just in a with a group of people that understand this. And basically you flirt with these things just to relate to others. And I think it's more than just right-wing, left-wing, and rather just a position that if you have an open mind, you can understand.
And I think a big part of it is creating a clear aesthetic visual imagery of a kind of utopian society that you want to live in. And it goes back to that quote Rabbit keeps saying, that true freedom, I think Pat Buchanan said it, and he's a lot more socially conservative, but true freedom is not doing whatever you want, but living in the kind of society you want to live in. And I think visual imagery is the most effective way of putting that image out there. Would you agree, Rabbit?
I think so. And I think that there, Pilliter brings up a good point about the avant-garde, because, you know, it's going to attract a lot of the weirder people, because a large segment of the alt-right has this very rigid kind of traditionalist view of society. And that doesn't really, you know, that's very off-putting to people who are like imaginative or creative writers and what, you know, you have some within that realm, but they're looking to like really get back to something, you know, or they're willing to get back to something, but they're not like a lot of the more like imaginative, creative kind of eccentric weirdos and whatnot are going to be put off by this very rigid kind of way of thinking, which I'm okay with being rigid on certain issues, you know, that I think are the most, should be the most prioritized, but, you know, not necessarily, I'm willing to entertain all kinds of other stuff on, you know, on aesthetics and, you know, historical framing and even just like the futurism and things like that. And the type of society that should be like, those people have a very rigid idea of what, you know, they have it set basically what kind of society that they want to see. It's like a you know, a traditionalist pre-modern society that, you know, with maybe, you know, modern plumbing or something like that, basically, you know, so anything outside of that, they're just like, ugh. You know, that's degenerate, that doesn't work, that's not part of nature, and whatnot. So we do attract all of these avant-garde eccentric types. And the only really like concrete segment of the alt-left are like the people that became attracted to it, which are kind of my, kind of the ones that make me shrug and just kind of groan, are the ones that like, you get those people from the left that just think that like identity politics have gone too far. And so they want to just like get rid of all identity politics and no one has an identity.
You're saying the sort of left-wing, the left-wing equivalent of the conservative colorblind civic nationalism is what you're getting at.
Yeah, exactly. You know, those people that are like, and I kind of like, I like some of those people because they're, you know, they're not easily offended and they're not like constantly like breathing down our necks or anything, but at the same time, like, you know, in a way I can appreciate the like the more SJW types, because at least they're like, you know, at least they believe in like the concept of identity, you know, even if they actually don't, like, they don't want white people to have an identity, at least they understand like the importance of having an identity. And and so you have these other people that are kind of, they're really similar to, like you said, like the normie Republican types, in that they want to be completely colorblind, except that they want to just focus on class. But of course they want to focus on it from, you know, from the left, like, as opposed to from like these other conservatives that want to just like, we're colorblind, but you know, it's all about the free market.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Rabbit for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Thanks again.
And also, thanks, Pilliter.
Nice talking to you, Rabbit.
You too.